Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of May. On Earth Day of this year, our guest, who's joined us several times before and is always a great delight, arrived at the North Pole. Eric Larson, polar explorer, explorer of the whole world, has been to the top and the bottom, and soon he will be to the roof of the world. It's a major expedition. He's already gone to the North Pole and to the South Pole, and will be soon on an expedition to the summit of Mount Everest. It is to promote clean energy solutions, to advocate strategies for reducing carbon emissions post-Kyoto 2012, and to collect scientific data, to produce a documentary, a film, to develop a post-expedition multimedia lecture series. He's an incredible adventurer, a modern-day explorer. He's a polar explorer, a dog musher, an adventure racer and educator, and he has been over the past 12 years in some of the most remote and wild places left on this earth. He has traveled enough wilderness miles to circle the globe nearly 2.5 times. We're going to talk about the latest trek to the North Pole and upcoming trip to Everest, and we've talked about the South Pole. He has a website which is absolutely gorgeous, and we'll talk about issues like global warming and what he's seen. And welcome your phone calls for Eric as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Hello, Eric. Welcome. I don't know where your home is anymore. Welcome home again, huh?
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I unfortunately don't really know where my home is, but no matter where I go, Wisconsin will always be my ultimate home for sure.
All right. We like that. So you went to the North Pole. You got home, you got there on Earth Day. Was that planned?
It was not planned, and it was actually quite a surprise. We had hoped to maybe be there by the 25th, and we just kind of got into some ice conditions that were really favorable, and we were able to push and get to the North Pole on Earth Day. And for me, it was kind of one of the biggest successes of the entire trip, because it just meant, I guess, like an exclamation point on what our message was, which is just an environmental message and a message of stewardship for our planet.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the North Pole, which has this incredible significance that the quality of our lives, well, why don't you say it? It's better in your words, what the North Pole means for all of us.
Yeah, it's kind of the one, besides the South Pole, it's the one place that connects us all. It's where all the lines of longitude begin and grow until they touch basically everybody on our planet. And so it's really the place where we're all connected, and I think that's a good analogy, because not only for just us physically, but in terms of our environment, we all are connected. And if we do something in one spot, it's eventually going to affect the rest of us on our planet. So it's a very good analogy for that.
And you did the South Pole, and now you're going to Mount Everest.
Correct.
Oh, yeah, my
gosh. I'll be leaving for Everest the end of August with a hopeful summit date right around the third week in October.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the North Pole expedition, Eric. From where did you start, and how long a journey was it?
We started from the northernmost point in Canada, a place called Cape Discovery on Ellesmere Island, and traveled around in a straight line distance about 490 miles, but we probably traveled about 550 miles due to all of our veering around ice and backwards drift of ice to the geographic North Pole.
Hmm. And what did you, you had to swim at some point too. What were you doing? You were skiing and walking and swimming, and what did you encounter?
The Arctic Ocean is a crazy place that people probably really shouldn't go to, because there's nothing about that place that really wants you there. And the Arctic is very different from Antarctica. Antarctica is a continent, so the ice you're skiing across is ice on land. Mm-hmm. The Arctic Ocean is ice that's floating on water, and it's constantly moving depending on the winds, the tides, and the ocean currents, and so it breaks apart, collides together. And our main form of transportation was either skiing or snowshoeing, but we did get to sections where the ice had cracked and split open, and even though temperatures are 30 or 40 below, there's still open water. Ooh. So we'd have to put dry suits on over all of our clothes and swim across these open sections of water.
Could you repeat what the temperature was?
30 or 40 below. Started out at about 40 below or a little colder, maybe 45, and it warmed up to maybe about 20 below. I think it was about 26 below when we got to the North Pole.
Oh, my goodness. And you, they make suits that you can go in the water in that kind of cold?
Yeah, it's especially, well, actually the water is warmer than the air because the water is, it's a little colder than freezing because it's salt water. So it's, you know, maybe 30 degrees, 29 degrees. So when you get in the water with this special dry suit that goes on over all your clothes, and you're moving and sometimes breaking thin ice with my body, it's actually pretty warm. So it's getting out in the cold and the wind that's a little less comfortable.
What did you find in terms of loss of ice?
It was pretty stark. Unfortunately, just as a side note, we're still kind of having this conversation on evidence of global warming, which ironically is where we were at in 2006 when I did my first trip to the North Pole. And I do feel like the conversation should change to solutions. However, I do think it's important to kind of keep talking about some of this evidence. And, you know, in terms of what physical evidence we saw, I felt it was very dramatic this year. And there are a few big things. One is that the ice drifted very quickly and erratically, and basically it depended whichever way the wind was blowing, the ice would start moving, and we would go to sleep at night and wake up maybe 2 miles. We would check our GPS and we'd be 2 miles away from the position where we went to sleep because the wind had blown not just our little piece of ice, but all the ice around us in that direction. And so we seem to drift very erratically depending on the wind. And to me, what that means is there's less landlocked ice around the perimeter of the Arctic Ocean. And so just like a cork in an ocean affected by the wind, we were the same thing and just moving back and forth depending on the wind.
Mm-hmm.
We also saw really variable weather conditions that would change dramatically within just a couple hours. We could be traveling in a stiff wind that was coming from the northwest, and it would switch in just a couple hours to calm, and then almost 180 degrees the opposite. So that was, I felt, very unusual, just that quick change in weather. And then lastly, we saw throughout the entire trip just a lot of ice that was really broken up, and we call it pressured, where pans or sheets of ice have collided and kind of formed chunks, and snow gets drifted around there. And so you're kind of weaving in and around all these little pieces of ice and snow drifts. And we just had that condition, or those types of conditions throughout the entire journey versus historically where expedition people would travel across ice and it would be a big flat sheet, and then they would come up to a really heavily pressured area that would have blocks of ice that were as big as trucks, and that would be, you know, a very defined section. And now it's just kind of rough throughout the entire journey, and to me that indicates that the ice is overall thinner and it breaks easier. So I think those are a few of the things that I noticed.
Right. And you also did groundbreaking work on that trip in 2006, didn't you? I mean, you were all over the place in terms of interviews, giving us on the ground or on the ice information about global warming.
Right. Yeah. And that's really the strength of these trips, is we're able to go to places that not a lot of scientists can go to.
Mm-hmm.
But not only that, and I feel equally important, is really just telling a story of these places. A lot of people don't understand how unique these ecosystems are, or that the Arctic Ocean is actually an ocean and Antarctica is a continent. And so hopefully connecting people to a place and telling their story and showing how unique they are and that they are changing.
Right. What's it like physically to be there, Eric? Can you tell where the sky begins and the land is, or do you feel like it's all one?
It really depends. I mean, there are days where, you know, it's just beautiful. The sky is blue and the snow is sparkling and you can see little crystals kind of reflecting light as you ski along. That's a good day. A bad day is a whiteout where it's overcast and the sky and the snow just meld into the same thing, and you realistically can't even see any sort of variation in the snow underneath your skis, so you're almost skiing blindly. It's like being in a room when the lights go out and trying to wait for your eyes to adjust, but instead of being dark or black, it's white. So your eyes are always trying to find something, but you really can't see anything. And then we would ski right into a chunk of ice and fall over, and it was very difficult to go in a straight line, and so we use our compass on a little bracket and just look down at the compass and follow that bearing without looking around at any of the conditions, and it's dangerous because you fall over a lot of times. It's very hard to go straight. And
Yeah, the difficult. Whole thing seems extremely dangerous to me. I know that you've seen, and I would love to have you. You know, you should do a book on this. One of you, I know you did a diary of every day that you were on the. It's not on the road. You were on the ice.
On the trail, we call it.
That you don't have a list of the most incredible things you've ever seen, but wouldn't I love to read a book about that? You should do that.
Goal is to hopefully have a book after Save the Poles is over, for sure.
Okay, good. But on this particular journey, this is day 45 or day 44 or day 46. I don't think it's day 45. This would be on it, you write. You're walking on a – do you remember this day on a thin ice lead when suddenly you felt the ice shift violently to your left?
Yeah, that was incredible. It was probably one of the – I think I wrote as one of the most incredible things I've ever witnessed. It was really interesting to see how the ice was affected by the elements, the wind and the tides. And early on, we were skiing across, you know, these pans, and you see 5-foot slabs of ice kind of shoved up in the air, 8 or 9 or 10 or 20 feet, and you really wonder how, you know, what forces or what conditions. Was it a big storm, you know, where the wind was just blowing very severely, or how did that happen? And realistically, it's just a steady force. And we were skiing along a lead, which can be an open section of water, but this was one that was kind of newly frozen. So just ice that was maybe a couple inches thick. And there was enough energy stored up in the ice where this whole big slab of ice that we were on shifted over to our left, maybe Ooh. Just a couple inches. And we all looked at each other and were just amazed. And it happened again and then again. And AJ, my partner from England, said, "Oh, I should get out my camera." And then as he kind of turned around to his sled to get his camera out, his video camera, it stopped, and we never witnessed it again. So it was a fleeting moment, but one that we just felt very lucky to witness, because, again, it's just another aspect that makes that place so unique and so different from anywhere else on our planet.
All right. Let's welcome phone calls. Eric Larson is our guest. He has just returned again from a journey to the North Pole. He did the South Pole a few months ago, and he is, as you heard him say, in August, going to Mount Everest. And all in the name of pay attention to our environment. 800-486-8655 is the number. Clyde from Cedarburg is our first caller. Hello, Clyde.
Hi. Thank you very much, Kathleen, for having this famous Arctic explorer, Antarctic explorer on your program. It's a real privilege to be able to speak with a living Arctic and Antarctic explorer's broken ice done unique expeditions, and is doing them right now. Taking the opportunity using this to publicize the concerns about the future of our planet. There's another also still living breathing and working Antarctic explorer, Will Steger, who sponsored several. Will Steger, by the way, did the first traverse on skis and with dogs across the entire Antarctic continent, which is the first one to have done it, done the expedition that Ernest Shackleton attempted to do and failed to do, for which he became famous. And Will Steger sponsored a youth delegation to the Copenhagen conference. Two of those delegates that happen to be from Wisconsin, recently put on a presentation sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Milwaukee and Ozaukee counties, and they just did a dynamite performance. So I just want to bring that to your attention.
Yeah, and also that's great. I know Will personally, and he's a great guy and also a hero from mine, and I've studied a lot about his expeditions. His North Pole expedition is 86, the Traverse of Antarctica, and 89, and across in the Arctic Ocean. He's doing a lot of great things, and I talk with his PR team a lot about how we can coordinate our efforts, because he's not doing as many physical expeditions anymore, but he's definitely taking his experiences and bringing it to a larger audience involving students, and I think that's a really admirable goal, and I've learned a lot from him, not only just from physical expeditions and techniques, but also from an education perspective. And I know for me, the education point is very important. And on my website, SaveThePoles.com, we have a a curriculum that talks a lot about climate change and the science behind climate change that students can and teachers can download for free.
And you do quite a bit of speaking yourself when you're not off on one of these
expeditions. I think the strength of what I do is just storytelling. And I really enjoy being able to share these stories with people, again, to connect them to a place. And, you know, whether it's the website, I think, which is a great forum to involve people around the planet, but just that firsthand interaction where I can go out and talk to people and have and do a short little presentation, I feel is another great connecting point. And I really enjoy doing that.
Mm-hmm. How did you enter the world of expeditions, Eric?
Good question. I'm not really sure. You know, as a kid, I spent a lot of time outside. My dad was the director of River Edge Nature Center, which is in Newburg, Wisconsin.
Great place.
And so I spent a lot of time out there, a lot of family camping trips and a lot of trips with River Edge, kind of youth groups, and doing my own trips as I got older in high school, you know, big expeditions down Cedar Creek with a friend of mine and things like that. But I had always read about the Arctic and Arctic travel and knew in the back of my mind that I wanted to do expeditions and just kind of took opportunities that I was able to get more experience and farther north. And so it was a slow evolution of learning and skills and practice.
And you have to be in incredible physical shape, I would think.
Definitely, training is a big part of my life.
Yes.
And I kind of have this philosophy, it's train hard and travel easy. Because a big part of these trips is so physical. It's definitely a challenge to have the energy to make it through every day. However, I will say that the mental aspect of these trips is equally as difficult, and both of them feed off of each other.
We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. Eric Larson is our guest, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Eric Larson, our guest, he is having quite a year. He's been to the South Pole. He has just returned from a trip to the North Pole. He will be going to Mount Everest very shortly, just in August. And his expedition is Save the Poles. And the reason for doing this is to draw attention to the state of our planet, to look at clean energy solutions, to advocate strategies for reducing carbon emissions, to produce a documentary, a film, and a book, and to tell the story of what the world is and the kind of shape that the world is in. We go next to Wayne from Hayward. Hi, Wayne.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah. My brother just got done doing the Polar Challenge ski race up there.
Sure, yeah. We've been in contact. He's emailed me a couple times. That is in a different area. It's in basically what you could consider the historic Northwest Passage, and it's from a little outside a small community on Cornwallis Island called Resolute to a couple hundred miles away where the magnetic North Pole was in 1996, which is different than where it is right now. But, yeah, definitely a cool trip for sure, and there's a lot of, I think, there's a lot more interest in the polar regions, and I think tourism is becoming more prominent as well, which I think it can be a good thing because it exposes people to those fragile areas.
Tourism. It's hard to imagine there would be many people who would be up to the rigors of this.
It is, but, I think much like Everest, there are people who are interested in kind of physical challenges and going to some of these remote places. And I think, it's a double-edged sword because these are very fragile places and humans can have a very big impact, myself included, on these places. And so I think now is the time to look at how that's done and make sure that it's done responsibly and also respectfully, I feel,
mm-hmm.
and safely for sure.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about, thank you, Wayne, very much for your call. Tell us about more that you traveled with within a narrow margin of safety. You write you had limited resources and had to conserve and meter food and fuel. And then we'll do the broader question of how we all need to do that. But you have to travel fairly lightly, even though you're doing this amazing journey.
Yeah, I mean, basically everything that we're carrying to live and survive with us as we travel. So if we run out of fuel for our stove or food, we just, we can't go to the store and pick up anymore.
No,
I mean,
store.
The closest store is thousands and thousands of miles away. So as a precursor to that, there's a lot of planning that goes into that, all those rations and supplies that we carry with. But on the trail, we have to be very careful and live just very conservatively so that we're not overextending ourselves or eating too much or burning too much fuel. And as we travel, that narrow margin of safety is pretty evident because it's so cold. It's 30 degrees, 40 degrees below zero, yet we're working very hard, and so we're not wearing a lot of clothes. The ice is thin, you know, several of my team members fell through the ice into the water, hypothermia, you know, cold water submersion, you stop, and it's very easy to get cold, almost to the point of being unable to help yourself should you get any colder. I mean, there are several times where my hands were so cold that I, you know, couldn't do my zipper, and that might not seem like a big deal to you or I sitting in our houses or walking out to the car, but, you know, at that temperature, that one little problem can have a big effect that's going to affect how the severity of the next problem and also the rate at which those next problems happen. So it's kind of this domino effect that can happen. So it is a very narrow margin of being safe out there. And if you are careful, you can kind of, I was going to say skate, but for us it's ski that line and be somewhat safe for most of the time. But little things can have dramatic effects, and that can be very easy. So you're kind of on constant watch to make sure that you're staying on that line and not veering too much to either side, because it can go down and it can go very into a dangerous survival situation very quickly.
Hmm. And as you say that, I'm thinking of the larger picture and the world as it is right now, and that applies to the world as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. And one of the things, and I think as Americans and as humans, we're definitely consumers. And like for me, I don't want to have a very difficult life all my life. I want to be comfortable. But I think on an expedition, you realize what the things that we need to survive, and it's not a lot. And so I think that's a good lesson to realize for all of us, that there are things that we need to survive, and then there are other things. And I think using less, conserving resources is a good start. You know, I don't think we need to give up all the comforts of our life. I don't necessarily want to do that. But little things like conservation, turning off lights, recycling, using less, those are all important lessons that I think translate a lot, not only in our daily lives, but can also be incorporated in national policies for sure.
You have written, and I think this sums up a lot, we're all explorers in one fashion or another. Not many of us, very, very few like you, Eric. But the job of explorers in the 21st century is not to conquer, but to protect.
Yeah, definitely. And for me, in these trips, I call myself an explorer. But realistically, you know, people have been to the North Pole. People have been to the South Pole. And so, again, I go back to that storytelling kind of, that's what I do is tell a story of that place. And hopefully, you know, we're all exploring our planet in one way or another. And I think it's a very important aspect of our lives to make sure that we're taking care of our planet, our home.
We go back to phone calls for Eric Larson. Our number is 800-486-8655. Ray from Milwaukee. Hey, Ray.
Eric, I'm wondering here myself, as you say you want to save the planet, yet you're taking all these fantastic trips to the North Pole, South Pole, Everest. What gives you that right to do all that and use airplane fuel and gasoline and fuel to fuel your burners while you're up there trying to survive at 50 below zero? Why should you be able to do all that and leave this huge carbon footprint behind, and then you're putting your finger at us and saying that we shouldn't use carbon? I don't get this. I ride a bike. I haven't been in a plane in 10 years.
Yeah, I don't think, I'm not trying to say that, I'm not pointing my finger at anybody, because I know that I'm as much a part of the problem as anybody. As I mentioned earlier, I like to have a comfortable lifestyle. I use resources. I drive a car. I do all these things. I think, and in terms of my trips, there's definitely a very large carbon footprint for these expeditions. I'm not going to deny that at all. One of the things we do is buy carbon offsets to hopefully mitigate some of those, those fossil fuels that we're burning. So those are very good points. There's no question. And I think the goal of the expedition isn't for me to say I'm doing this and you're not doing this. I think, as I mentioned, we're all in this together. I have a philosophy on expeditions that says no one of us is as strong as all of us. It kind of looks at teamwork. And while as individuals we can do things, I think we're stronger as a team. And my goal really is for us to take a look at all of our actions and just try to do our little part. I have another philosophy that's just begin with one step. And so if we can all just take one step in whatever aspect our lives are, myself included, maybe more than everybody else, I think that can have a dramatic effect.
Well, we also need people to document what it is that's happening. And the only way to do that is to use an airplane, right? You have to do that to be able to get to see what the effect of global warming is on the Arctic or what's happening in Antarctica. There's just no other way to do it.
Definitely. And you know, I've come to realize that one of the reasons why maybe I do these trips is because not everybody can. You know, not everybody has the ability to go to these places, and yet they're still interested. And so maybe in one sense that I'm doing this for other people as well, because they necessarily can't be there.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Ray. Jackie from Drummond, hi.
Yeah, kind of along the same lines of Ray, but this is really interesting. I'm an armchair adventurer, and I just read High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in an Age of Greed, and I think that's a really eye-opener. I mean, Everest has been explored for so long, it's really become a real negative experience with all the pollution, you know, the oxygen left, you know, bodies left, people just with their goal of getting to the top, disregarding human life. He even talks, this is pretty interesting, prostitution and drugs at base camp. And that's just become such a trendy thing. Now, you're in shape to go, but it's just like all these people, you know, short-lifted up to the top with, you know, all this money. And you probably would make a better statement by not going because of all the number of people going and the degradation of that mountain, as you probably know.
Yeah, it's an interesting, these are very good points, and I think good points for discussion because they're all related to the issue. For me, mountaineering doesn't come naturally. You know, I'm from Wisconsin. We've got Timbs Hill, the highest point, which is, I don't know, 1,300 feet or something like that. So mountaineering isn't my first kind of love, really, even. And I like polar travel. And polar travel is really all about just the process and not really the end result. However, in the United States, polar travel is kind of ambiguous. Not a lot of people understand about the North Pole and South Pole. And so from a realistic fundraising point, I wanted to include Everest in this trip because it's very iconic. It's also an area that's really affected by global warming. The Himalayan plateau provides a lot of drinking water to, I think, about 40% of the world's population, and it's melting as well. But there are some very realistic concerns about tourism in some of these remote places and how they're affecting those places. I talked about it earlier. One of my goals in Everest is to take kind of the philosophy of polar travel and incorporate it into mountaineering, which is in polar travel, you're a very small, self-contained unit. You're carrying all your resources with you as well as your trash. And so I want to be able to incorporate some of that philosophy into my climbing of Everest.
Here's an email from Roy. Did Perry and Cook have sunglass eye protection on their journeys in the early 1900s?
I'm not sure so much about Perry and Cook were two explorers who were competing to become the first to the North Pole, and theoretically Perry made it after four attempts. And what they most likely used were something similar to what the Inuit were using, which is the native people that lived in northern Greenland and Canada at the time. And it was usually a whalebone sunglass that had just a narrow slit cut in them so that it only let in a fraction of the light to protect their eyes from snow blindness.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that something? Let's go to Roger from Rock County. Hi, Roger.
Hi. My question is, both on an expedition and when you're living at home or traveling, what are things that you do to conserve energy, to reduce your carbon footprint that we all can do? And I'm looking for something more than a compact fluorescent light or taking a bus.
Yeah, well, those things are, I still go back to those things because those are really simple ways to conserve energy. If you change your most used light bulb in your house to compact fluorescent, I can't remember the statistics, but you're saving quite a bit of energy. Recycling is also a big one. However, apart from that, if you're a homeowner, a big thing is getting a home energy audit. And you can go to epa.gov to find a list of who provides energy audits in your area. So that's really a big one. Another big one, electricity is the largest consumer or producer of carbon emissions in the United States. So anything you can do to conserve electricity is a big thing. So even something as little as turning off the lights. But for anybody who's in the market for a new appliance, getting an Energy Star appliance is also a big saver of electricity. And then the key is, for example, if you get a new refrigerator, don't take that old refrigerator and stick it in the basement and plug it in, but dispose of that properly. But on my website, SaveThePoles.com, if you go to the global warming page, I do have a kind of personal resource checklist that you can go through, and there's a lot of those kind of tips for the individual or the family or the homeowner or the renter or whatever of things that you can do to reduce your carbon emissions.
And on a larger level, the world, of course, needs to pass significant treaties, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Copenhagen, which didn't really deliver on some sort of international standards for either cap and trade on carbon emissions or regulation. Also in the United States, we need to keep working on the Clean Air Act, which is an important protector of clean air, but also carbon emissions as well.
Thank you very much for your call, Roger. Lines are open if you'd like to speak to Eric. 800-486-8655 is our number. A question comes in from Zach. How do you, because there are expenses involved with this, how do you fund your trip?
Well, I wish I was a millionaire, but I'm not.
I bet.
So any way I can, and what I do a lot is fundraising, and so whether it's donations through the website, SaveThePoles.com, or corporate sponsorships, I was really lucky to get sponsorship by Bing and Terramar and a few other companies for the North Pole trip. As well as just doing presentations and individual donations. I had a fundraiser last spring about the same time at the Cedarburg Cultural Center. And so a lot of individual contributions, a lot of corporate donations. And for the South Pole, I was actually very lucky because that trip I was working, I guided the trip to the South Pole.
You guided the trip?
Yeah, so I was working for a company that runs a lot of logistics in Antarctica, and that my two team members had signed up through that
mm-hmm.
organization.
And if you would, please, compare the difficulty of the expedition, Antarctica and the Arctic.
I spent a lot of time skiing to the North Pole thinking about which trip is physically or mentally more challenging. And Antarctica, there are probably less variables to deal with and less imminent danger. You're basically skiing across ice cap, which is just an undulating field of ice, and you're skiing uphill eventually to an elevation of about 9,000 feet for the last 120 miles or so. There's some minor crevasse damage, danger. It's cold, but not terribly cold, maybe 10 below, but the wind chills are 30 or 40 or 50 below. In Antarctica, you're dealing with kind of imminent colder temperatures, 30, 40 below, as I mentioned, but less wind, so it actually kind of feels warmer at times. But you're dealing with a lot of really seriously dangerous conditions that could threaten your life in a matter of minutes.
Mm.
Falling through the ice, really rough pressured ice, polar bears, although we didn't see any polar bears this year, big pressure ridges, blocks of ice. So I think the North Pole, even though the journey is shorter, is more physically dangerous and also scary. There's a lot of times where you're almost unable to move or don't want to move because you know that it's a very dangerous situation.
Yeah.
using small little pieces of ice as rafts as they're kind of moving underneath you and pushing yourself off a chunk and floating over to the other side of a safer section of ice, or skiing across this ice that's so thin it's kind of bending and rippling underneath your skis. But that said, I think the last part of Antarctica is actually very difficult because you are at that elevation and the snow is very dry. Your body doesn't recover as well because it's not metabolizing the energy from the food. And I think I was more tired at the end of the South Pole than I was at the end of the North Pole, even though it's kind of overall, I would say, an easier expedition. But easy is, of course, a relative term.
Yes, it sure must be. Was that significant that you didn't see any polar bears?
It was significant in the fact that I felt a lot safer. But, you know, that time of year, the polar bears are more around the perimeter of the Arctic Ocean. We did see some tracks. And we did see quite a few seals, which I was surprised at. So I'm sure they were around in certain areas, but they're, you know, that time of year, the mothers are all in dens on land, which is one of the few times they actually come on land, and probably the males are wandering more towards the perimeter of the ice where there is more open water and their food source seals.
Jim from Superior, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, Jim. How are you?
Good. I just want to ask Eric what he thinks what can be done with companies that break the law as far as EPA regulations or other rulings with pollutants, and maybe get a fine which is only equal to what they may make in an hour or in a day. I just want to know what he feels with that. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, I don't have too much exposure with the regulation side of pollution and carbon emissions. I do know that there are a lot of organizations in the states that are driving a lot of regional and national policy towards energy efficiency standards as well as kind of emission standards because it's becoming a competitive necessity for them to be able to succeed. They need to have these energy efficient practices. They need to be able to keep up with some of the European and other countries who are already at this level. So I think businesses, more often than not, are starting to drive policy. I mean, there's companies like Nike who are actively lobbying our national government to have these standards so that they can be more competitive, and also because they feel it's a responsible thing to do.
Eric Larson is our guest, and we'll continue taking phone calls for him in just a moment. He has just returned from the North Pole. We spoke with him a few months ago when he had just returned from the South Pole, and he's going to be going to Mount Everest in phase three of the Save the Poles expedition. We'll hear more about his teammates and what you do to relax. How do you relax in the Arctic on a little piece of ice? I don't know. And also the psychology of getting along with people under those circumstances. How many people were on this journey and how many journeys have they taken together? How do you select the kinds of people who will be with you? That kind of thing. And more phone calls. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'd like to talk a little bit, Eric, about your excursion mates. Do you travel with the same people? How are they selected, and how do you get along with each other?
Well, you spend, 2 months in a tent that's about as big as your dining room table with anybody, and you're definitely bound to have some sort of conflicts. But team members and personalities of the group is something that's very important to me, and having a good team, because you're under very stressful conditions all the time and you're tired, cold, and all these things, and it's very easy to not be at your best. And so personality is an important part of the trip, as well as, you know, the practice of making decisions and cooperating. And it does take practice. I mean, these are skills, just like knowing how to tie a knot or drive a car or anything like that. So the team part for me is a very important aspect of the trip. And as I mentioned earlier, that philosophy I have is no one of us is as strong as all of us. I think as a team, we're able to accomplish more than as individuals. And for these trips, I know for a fact that I don't have much of a desire to do them just on my own, because they're difficult enough already. So being able to rely on people to do different parts of that those difficult tasks throughout the day is very important.
Do you travel with the same team members when you go to South America or to Antarctica?
Yeah, different groups involved, and I kind of went back and forth on that when I started planning basically 3 years ago, and what I decided was that I would have different teams. One, because no one is really able to put in all that time, and generally people who travel in polar regions aren't necessarily mountaineers, and mountaineers don't do polar travel, so just the hard skills are, there's a little disconnect there, and also just the amount of time and dedication and sacrifices that someone has to make to be able to put all the time in training and fundraising and arranging logistics and developing equipment, all the thing is all-encompassing. And then lastly, I wanted to have a different team just because I felt like it would allow the story to get out in more venues. And really, again, that's the goal of the trip, is to be able to tell that story and begin that conversation, much like we're having here, about, okay, what's the problem? What are we doing? And so if I could involve people from other countries or other regions, then I'm getting that conversation out in more areas. And that's kind of the ultimate reason why I made the decision.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jeff from Vermont Township. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen. You know, I was just thinking while your guest was talking about Michael Fay and his mega transect across Central Africa and how hard it was to keep his team's spirits up and even his own. But the reason I was calling was actually to get your caller's or your guest's view on Bill McKibben's opinion that we're kind of beyond the point of no return, and I'm wondering what his view is of that.
Yeah, I've heard that, and it's a difficult question because for me personally, I choose to be an optimist about most things and look on the positive side. But I do think, and from an expedition perspective as well, I've learned to be realistic, to set my expectations very clearly. My personal opinion is that we are in a situation where carbon emissions and CO2 levels in our atmosphere are still increasing, yet I do believe every little bit helps, and so I think it's important to maintain that attitude that we can still affect positive change for our environment, because I think to do otherwise is futile.
My question would be, what would your one thing be to ask of each of us to do daily to try to achieve that goal?
That's a good question, and I don't want to be telling each individual to do something. I think just do one thing, and I think what you kind of said it best, do one thing each day to make a difference, and I think that's a good place to start. I think this issue to be resolved or to have some sort of momentum in a direction where we are reducing carbon emissions in an effective and timely manner. As we need to be doing those one things as individuals, but we also need to be working on it from a national and an international policy standard, to set those standards of, you know, okay, we're going to try to limit emissions to 350 parts per million, things like that. So it needs to happen on an individual and also a bigger level as well.
Hey, thanks, and good luck with Everest.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. From a guy who describes himself as more of a polar guy, are you a little bit worried about Everest? Are you training for this particularly diligently?
I am worried about Everest, for sure. And the thing that I've learned over time is, in getting into new situations, that it's important to know what you don't know. And so for me, again, not knowing a lot about mountaineering, I've spent the last 3 years learning as much as I can about mountaineering. And so I've been working, you know, doing things like traveling down to Argentina and climbing down there to get up above 20,000 feet. I climbed Mount McKinley, Denali, last summer, just to get more experience, and spending some time out in Colorado this summer as well, just to be up at altitude and climb and do more mountaineering activities.
Does it affect you? Do you feel okay at that kind of altitude?
I don't think anybody feels okay. I felt like that I did really well at those altitudes, so I was pleased with my performance, for sure.
Well, that's good.
Yes,
we want to hear that. I was interested in one of the things that Jeff had brought up about keeping team spirits up. How do you accomplish that? Do you sing certain songs, or do you have rituals that you did that you would do every day? Because you have to keep your spirits up.
Yeah, and honestly, my philosophy on teamwork and group dynamics has evolved a lot over time. And one of the first things that I really emphasize with the team, and this may seem a little counterintuitive, but is a selfishness and taking care of yourself first. And because these environments are so extreme, really each person's job is to be healthy and happy and safe on their own first, because there's limited amount of personal energy that you have, and it's very difficult to extend that out to somebody else when you're tired. And so everything first needs to come through you. You need to make yourself happy. You need to make sure that you're safe, warm, have enough to eat. Once you're able to do that, then we work on some of these other systems that that kind of affect the team and helping one another out. For me, I try to do extra things for the team, and if that means navigating an extra shift or setting up the tent, taking over an extra chore, cooking, whatever. We also have some kind of special little treats. You know, AJ on the North Pole had his birthday, his 29th birthday, so I brought a little can of sardines for him that I
held. Oh, great. That was a great present.
Made a little card for him as well. We have team meetings in the morning just to discuss, like, certain things. But there's no question that there are times on a trip where the dynamics are difficult and we're very frustrated with one another. But, you know, the nice part is we don't have anywhere else to go. We rely on each other for safety, and we generally are able to sort out all those problems.
And how do you prepare for some kind of, not a huge emergency, but somebody getting sick, somebody getting hurt?
Well, hopefully the first thing is avoiding the situation and just developing a lot of systems that potentially we're not getting into the dangerous situation. But accidents can happen, and somebody definitely can get sick. First step is just trying to treat that ourselves. We have a very comprehensive first aid kit that we're bringing with, and then we set up kind of a series of kind of levels of danger, so to speak, or concern, and ultimately with a rescue mm-hmm. happening, which for all intents and purposes might not really even happen because we're in a spot where a plane couldn't get to or couldn't land. So it's there are definitely times in the trip where we're on our own, but you know, we are responsible recreators. Our goal is to be there, and we have a security deposit in place, so if we do need a rescue, it's not on somebody else's dime, it's on our money. That we actually, for our North Pole trip, we used Darcy, my Canadian teammate's mortgage to do
oh,
that.
Oh, did so you little, really?
Not something we wanted to do, but that's, you know, again, we want to be responsible for ourselves.
Uh-huh. And sardines were considered a treat on this as a birthday present, or were sardines part of your
No, that's definitely
menu?
A treat, because that's a heavy food item. I mean, they're in a metal can. They're not. Basically, all the food that we're eating is either dehydrated food or Clif energy bars. So there's not really a lot of variety to that. So to have something that's kind of oily and fatty and all that cold, and it's good. It's definitely a treat.
Is everybody comfortable with your doing this now for so many years, Eric? It must be hard for your family, though, to have you off in such incredibly remote places, just pushing yourself to the limit.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'm going to be back in Cedarburg this weekend, and we're finally going to be able to celebrate Christmas as a family.
Aww.
So that'll be nice, because I haven't been back to Wisconsin since, I think, September or October. So, there are those aspects to it that are very difficult, and with all my relationships, it's difficult with my friends, my girlfriend especially. I've been gone for 4 out of the past 6 months, so it's hard to have a sustainable relationship when you're really physically not there, although we are able to talk on a satellite phone, which doesn't necessarily make up for it, but it does help, and she's been very patient with me, which I appreciate.
And she's wondering when you're going to settle down, perhaps?
No comment.
Yeah. Oh, Eric, I think eventually you'll have to settle down. It's not like, bye, honey, I'm going to be gone for a little while. You're really gone when you're gone.
Yeah.
You are really gone. Are you giving any lectures or anything in this area while you're home?
You know, I'm just home for a little bit, just a few days, so nothing planned, but hopefully I'll have some things lined up, and if anybody is interested or has ideas for venues, feel free to email me through SaveThePoles.com. But always love coming back to Wisconsin and telling a story. Usually we'll have a show sometime sooner or later, maybe at the end of the summer or before Everest or after at the Cedarburg Cultural Center for sure.
Wonderful. Oh, and your pictures are so extraordinary. I just love seeing the last batch. Thanks, Eric. All the best to you. Keep climbing, and we'd love to hear from you after the next expedition.
Sounds good. I really appreciate the time.
Yeah, our pleasure. Eric Larson, exploring the North Pole again. He's been to the South Pole, all this just in the past couple months, and he's on his way to Everest to draw attention to the poles on this Earth and how they reflect how we're taking care of the Earth and also reflect how we need to take better care of the Earth. SaveThePoles.com is his website, and you really should see some of the pictures. They are just out of this world. Well, they're a part of this world, but they're out of this world, too. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios. Thanks, as always, for your participation in the program. We'll be with you again tomorrow, starting at 9 o'clock. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.